This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Tonight, the Tamil family at the centre of a years-long immigration battle set to return home to Biloela in central Queensland. Also, a diverse group of religious leaders is demanding an urgent First Nations voice referendum. But not all Indigenous people think recognition should be based on the Uluru Statement roadmap. And in the week since the election, the value of carbon credits has jumped 20%. But the market's critics are raising concerns about the science they're based on.
The problem with a distorted or broken carbon offset scheme is that it essentially retards the transition through to a low carbon economy. The reason we got into this mess in the first place is that there's good political reasons for people to turn a blind eye.
First tonight, a Tamil asylum seeker family who've spent 4 years in immigration detention will soon be heading back to the central Queensland town of Biloela after an intervention by the new federal government. The Nuttasalingam family were removed from the town in 2018 and sent into detention on Christmas Island. They've mounted a series of challenges to stop their deportation to Sri Lanka and have most recently been living in community detention in Perth. Our reporter Isabel Masali joins me now with the latest. Isabel, what can you tell us about this decision today?
Well, Acting Home Affairs Minister Jim Chalmers released a statement this afternoon confirming he'd intervened in the well-known case of the Tamil asylum seekers, the Nuttasalingam family. The statement said the effect of the intervention enables the family to return to Biloela, where they can reside lawfully in the community on bridging visas while they work towards the resolution of their immigration status in accordance with Australian law. He also said he's spoken with the family today and wishes them well. Now, this announcement was expected because Labor had made an election pledge to allow the Tamil family to stay in Australia, and it became clear this week that it was a priority. Now, Sam, just for some context on this really long battle, Nadas and Priya came to Australia by boat and had their daughters here. The family was removed from the Queensland town in 2018 and they were taken to Christmas Island at one point and then medically evacuated to Perth, where they are currently in community detention. And this whole time, the family has been fighting a long legal battle to remain in Australia.
And what's been the reaction to the news in Biloela?
Well, this town in central Queensland has been part of the fight. They've been running campaigns to get them home. Angela Frederick is a friend of the family and has been waiting by the TV all afternoon to hear the news. She's confident they'll be back in the town by mid-June, which is in time for Tanaka's fifth birthday. Here's what she had to say.
Ever since Saturday, the election, this town has felt lighter. It has felt like we are on the home stretch. And this call today has just echoed through the community that this is really happening. And we just are all so excited and can't wait for that day. The town here once again has just rallied. So there have been so many offers of accommodation, of work opportunities, of furniture, all those things. So this family, they are going to just be completely cradled and looked after until they're back on their feet, which knowing them, it will not take them long.
Now, Labor had been pushing for this for some time, but Nationals MP Barnaby Joyce is also celebrating the news today. He's been a supporter of the family's campaign, putting him at odds with the Morrison government. He spoke to the ABC a short time ago.
Well, that is good news. Those girls were born in Australia, and to Australia they should return. And I believe that ultimately this should have happened some time ago. What is required is for people to understand that we have strong borders, but we are not without ministerial discretion and we are not without a sense of compassion when required. And this one really, for me, was always logical. The girls were born in Australia.
The Nationals leader, Barnaby Joyce, and before him, our reporter, Isabel Masali. Labor is accusing the former government of risking lives and politicising national security by publicising the interception of an asylum seeker boat on the day of the federal election. The ABC has revealed Scott Morrison's office instructed Australian Border Force to make the information public. Shortly afterwards, the Liberal Party sent texts to voters in marginal seats telling them to, quote, keep our borders secure by voting Liberal today. Now Whitehead has more.
It was the Coalition's policy not to comment on water matters. It argued it would undermine national security to reveal when or if asylum seeker boats were turned around. On election day, Scott Morrison broke with that convention. The ABC's revealed today that he directly requested the Australian Border Force to publish information about the interception of a boat from Sri Lanka. The ABF issued a statement as voting was underway, and shortly afterwards, Mr. Morrison spoke about the turnback at a press conference.
There has been an interception of a vessel en route to Australia, and I can simply say this. I've been here to stop this boat, but in order for me to be there to stop those that may come from here, you need to vote Liberal and Nationals today.
The ABF's normal approach is to release monthly reports about Operation Sovereign Borders and not to publish individual press releases. The new Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has ordered an inquiry into what happened on election day.
Very clearly, this statement was made so that it could facilitate the sending of, we're not sure how many, but potentially many millions of text messages to voters in a last-minute scare campaign. It was an entire abuse of proper processes.
Australia's border policies are broadly bipartisan. Labor supports boat turnbacks and offshore detention. Deputy Prime Minister Richard Marles calls the election day announcement a disgrace.
But if those reports are correct, then this represents the final desperate acts of a dying government. In the last few hours of the Morrison government, what we have seen revealed is the true character of the Liberal Party. Because what's completely clear is that the Liberal Party does not care about the national interest. It only had regard for their political interest.
He accuses the government of risking lives by politicising national security.
This is a matter that should have been above politics. This is a matter where actually, when it came to border security, there was a national consensus that this government sought to undermine. It sought to create division where none existed, and it sought to make this a matter of politics. And this is really serious. It's serious in the sense that it did make our borders less secure. It's serious in that it risked lives. It risked lives.
The government was already in caretaker mode when the announcement was made. Mr. Morrison's office spoke to Mr. Albanese's. The new Prime Minister says he didn't support the move and calls it a clear breach of caretaker conventions. But constitutional law professor Anne Twomey says that's not the case.
The caretaker conventions themselves don't directly address this. Caretaker conventions are there to make sure that there are no major policy decisions, significant appointments or major contracts made during the caretaker period so that it binds an incoming government.
She points to other concerns about politicising the public service.
In the public service legislation, they have what they call APS values, and that includes a requirement to act in a manner that's impartial and apolitical. And in order to give effect to that, there are a set of standards and principles that are put in place, and they're actually included in the caretaker convention manual that's put out by the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. And it sets out a number of statements. So two of the relevant ones are these. First of all, it says that agencies should avoid active distribution of material if it promotes government policies or emphasises the achievements of the government. And the second one, it says, consistent with APS values of impartiality, it may be appropriate for an agency to decline a request from a minister if it was clearly for use in an election campaign. The real question here is the appropriateness of the public service in making the announcement. Now, there's an argument that the announcement is simply stating facts, and if that's the case, then, of course, public servants are allowed to do that. But the question is, was it really tying it to a government policy?
PM contacted Mr. Morrison's office, who said the statement was released by officials and did not comment further. Former Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton has backed Mr. Morrison's decision.
I think wait for the investigation and then instead of the allegations being pushed by Labor, we'll understand the facts and then they can present that. But there's no evidence that I've seen of Scott Morrison having done anything wrong.
The boatload of asylum seekers intercepted on election day has been returned this week to Sri Lanka.
Neil Whitehead reporting. While there's been good news for the Nada Salingham family this afternoon, many other asylum seekers and refugees in Australia are hoping the new government will take a more compassionate approach to their cases too. Labor has vowed to maintain tough border protection measures, but it has committed to a major policy change, the scrapping of temporary protection visas for asylum seekers who arrived by boat. One visa holder says he hopes the move will finally end years of anxiety for thousands of refugees. Matt Bamford reports.
Life in Australia has been filled with uncertainty for Afghan refugee Zaki Haidari. The Hazara fled Taliban persecution before 2013. Because he arrived by boat, he's been on a temporary protection visa.
I keep feeling that I'm not an equal human being to an Australian citizen. I've always been treated as a second citizen in this country.
Around 19,000 refugees are on temporary protection visas. Financial support from the government is limited. Overseas travel is restricted and they cannot sponsor relatives to join them. They also have to reapply every 3 to 5 years.
We can never call Australia a permanent home. In terms of mental health as well, it has been a toll on refugees. Everything is on a daily basis for us and we didn't have a hope to move forward.
During the election campaign, Labor talked tough on border protection.
The key to keeping our borders strong are the elements of the plan that would turn back boats, which we support, offshore processing, which we support, and settlement in third countries, which we support. Anyone who comes by boat will not get any visa here in Australia. They won't be allowed to settle here in Australia. We have the same position on all of those issues.
Despite sharing the coalition's stance on many border policies, it's promised to scrap temporary protection visas.
Nobody has gone on temporary protection visas since the introduction of Operation Sovereign Borders. The only people on temporary protection visas are people that came under Liberal and Labor governments prior to the introduction of Operation Sovereign Borders. They are people that the Liberal government recognised as refugees. They have been living and working in Australia for more than a decade. They pay taxes. They employ Australians. They are not part of the Operation Sovereign Borders policy.
Jana Favero from the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre says it's a significant point of difference.
It's not something that Labor did sing from the rooftops. There are 19,000 people who are currently on temporary protection or CHEV visas, and one of the first things Labor have committed to is making those into permanent protection visas, and that is something we welcome because it will absolutely transform the lives of 19,000 people and their families.
Labor's promise to increase the cap on humanitarian visas and speed up visa applications.
While both parties still committed to maintaining an architecture of offshore processing and mandatory detention, a big difference between the Liberal and Labor parties was that the Labor Party have said that they would bring in a 90-day maximum rule for people to be in detention.
Independents and the Greens also want to make their own changes.
All of them have stood up and have said, end to TPVs and CHEVs. All of them have stood up and said, families must be able to be together. All of them have stood up and said there has to be reform and look at what is happening offshore in our name, because we can't forget there are still 200 people who are trapped on Papua New Guinea and Nauru.
Anyone who arrives by boat today will not be allowed to settle in Australia. But for people like Zaki Haidari, who've been living in the community for more than a decade, progress is finally within reach.
It's a dream come true, and I do hope that the time has arrived now and I feel like I can call Australia my permanent home and eventually I'll become an Australian citizen. But in terms of my family, I can finally find a path there for them to sponsor them and save their lives because they're in Afghanistan.
Hazara refugee Zaki Hadari. Matt Bamford reporting. You're listening to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Just a reminder, you can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. The Foreign Minister Penny Wong is continuing her Pacific Islands tour as China keeps up its diplomatic push in the region. On her second day in Fiji, Senator Wong emphasised her desire for Australia to remain the partner of choice in the region and reiterated her concerns about China's security agreement with the Solomon Islands. China's Foreign Minister has now arrived in Kiribati for a brief visit that's being closely managed by his entourage. Priyanka Srinivasan prepared this report.
A warm welcome from members of the eKiribati Chinese community as China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi drove by. The remote Pacific nation was the second stop on Wang Yi's whirlwind eight-state tour of the region. He travelled through the capital Tarawa in a heavily guarded motorcade, which local journalist Ramon Ramon was following.
He was escorted by police. He's got a motorcade of about six or seven cars in total. I stopped over at the president's residence to take some footage. Was told by police to I was not allowed to do that, even though I tried to, you know, explain that I'm trying to do my job. The talks are completely out of bounds for the media.
Just yesterday, the Chinese foreign minister was in Solomon Islands conducting a flurry of closed-door meetings. Little is known about what the two nations discussed, nor what agreements were made. It was a similar story in Kiribati today. But there have been reports a similar security deal, like the one struck with Honiara, is on the table.
There's certainly some agreements. The president and the president's office did release some kind of information about some kind of agreement. And I think the significance of Kiribati being in right at the equator and perhaps at the closest neighbor to our far Kiribati eastern islands are about 2 hours flight away from the United States. So I'm certain that Kiribati has a far more significance than Solomon Islands in terms of the geopolitics of the whole U.S. and China battle in the Pacific. But, you know, like I said, we've been trying to get the information even from our own government, and it's been really hard to get information.
China is seeking to dramatically expand security and commercial ties with the region. A leaked communique reveals it wants a region-wide deal with almost a dozen Pacific nations. In Kiribati, there are concerns China plans to upgrade an airstrip on the strategic important island of Canton, about 3,000 kilometres southwest of Hawaii. England Utah is a member of parliament in Kiribati and said he has raised concerns about the project to the government.
That's what we worried about. I hope that nobody is, Chinese are not hoping to establish a base. Well, they've been saying that all along, but we don't know. That's a concern. We just don't want our island to be caught up in this build-up between the militaries and China's military build-up.
Meanwhile, in Fiji, new Foreign Minister Penny Wong was treated to a traditional cultural welcome this morning. She later said it was up to each Pacific Island nation to decide what partnerships they form and what agreements they sign. But she urged them to consider the benefits of sticking with Australia.
We want to be a partner of choice. We want to demonstrate to your nation and other nations of the region that we are a partner who can be trusted, who can be reliable, and historically we have been. Obviously, we've expressed our concerns publicly about the security agreement between Solomon Islands and China. And the reason we have is we think there are, as do other Pacific nations, we think there are consequences.
Dr. Sylvia Frain, a postdoctoral researcher from Auckland University, says the new government's renewed focus on climate change could do more to keep China at bay.
So to be able to really listen and amplify to these Pacific leaders and the Pacific community that climate change is the number one security threat is much welcomed to the region. Climate security, climate change, genuine security is really what the Pacific leaders have been saying all along is their number one priority.
And do you think by Australia bringing climate change to the table, it might actually encourage Pacific leaders to perhaps have closer ties with traditional, so-called traditional allies like you know, New Zealand, Australia, and the United States?
Absolutely, absolutely. This is something that they've been asking for a very long time. It's been falling on deaf ears about the importance of climate change. So to be able to bring that into the conversation, I think it will be much more effective in terms of the greater diplomacy.
Dr. Sylvia Frayne from Auckland University, ending that report by Priyanka Srinivasan. The election of a Labor government has seen the value of carbon credits jump 20% this week. The credits are bought to offset carbon emissions and are vital to achieving Australia's targets. But the sector is under scrutiny, with critics accusing many of Australia's carbon farming projects of relying on flawed science amounting to climate fraud. Labor is promising an independent review, and its findings could disrupt the path to net zero. John Daly reports.
The value of carbon credits purchased by government and heavy industry to offset emissions jumped in Labor's first week at the helm. It's not surprising given the new Labor government's more ambitious emissions reduction target of 43% by 2030 that will largely be achieved by tightening pollution limits on Australia's biggest emitters. Louisa Kiley owns Carbon Farmers of Australia, and she says it's good news for the sector.
Certainly. We were going to fall behind. We had fallen behind. Now we've got a chance to lead again. We've got a chance to lead again in agriculture. We've got a chance to show what agriculture can do both domestically and internationally.
One Australian carbon credit unit, or ACCU, equals one tonne of greenhouse gas emissions. And the previous coalition government set up a $4.5 billion fund to buy them. It's key to Australia's pathway to net zero by 2050. But there's a big problem. Whistleblowers in this field say most of them are rubbish and have alleged major flaws in the main methods in which as much as 80% of carbon credits are generated. ANU Law School Professor Andrew McIntosh went public with this earlier this year, and he says it has big consequences for Australia's efforts to tackle climate change.
As Labor introduces its new policies, more large polluters rely on offsets to mitigate emissions. Now, if those credits don't represent real and additional abatement, then we get an increase in emissions from the large polluter, and there's no reduction elsewhere. But at a more fundamental economic level, the problem with a distorted or broken carbon offset scheme is that it essentially retards the transition through to a low carbon economy. You're sending the wrong price signals to the large polluters where the cost of abatement is high and it's hard to abate in those sectors. What they're seeing is a distorted price signal caused by a broken system.
The carbon farming industry and industry watchdog, the Clean Energy Regulator, have both rejected these accusations. John Connor is the CEO of the Carbon Market Institute, and he says the methods and the science of carbon projects in question are sound.
There's been some extreme calls and some and unfortunate language and the like that's been used. We think it will stand up to scrutiny on the whole, but there's definitely going to be issues and things that we should be looking at, and importantly, to reform this, because it's very important to have a market that has confidence.
Labor committed to a full and independent review of Australia's carbon credit system back in March. Andrew McIntosh worries that's just political lip service.
Yes, of course, there's a concern that all this will be swept under the carpet. The reason we got into this mess in the first place is that there's good political reasons for people to turn a blind eye. So I still have that concern, but I take Labor at their word, and I'm hoping that the glare of outsiders will force the government and others to change course and restore integrity to this system.
Another big question is if Australia will even have enough low-cost carbon credits to meet its climate goals without breaking the bank. In March, the coalition government backed out of a bunch of low-cost carbon credit supply contracts, allowing them to instead be sold to the private market. Carbon farmer Louisa Kiley says a lack of supply of credits is a problem.
If you had 100,000 in your pocket today, John, you would be able to sell them. Supply is the absolute issue. If you don't have one in your pocket today, John, it's going to take you between 1 and 5 years to get one.
Right, so you're saying that there needs to be new methods, new ways of doing carbon projects to create enough supply of credits.
Absolutely, and unless we do get these additional methods, you know, CCS won't be ready for a long time. even direct carbon capture from the air. We've waited too long. That is the issue.
Carbon Farmers of Australia owner Louisa Kiely ending John Daly's report. Religious leaders gathered in the Sydney suburb of Barangaroo today to support a referendum on an Indigenous voice to Parliament. 5 years ago, the Uluru Statement of the Heart called for the Constitution to include that voice in the form of a representative body to help shape policies affecting First Nations people. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, again committed to the statement in his victory speech. But not all First Nations people support the statement's blueprint. Carly Williams explains.
A landmark cultural event. Uluru Statement from the Heart campaigners and faith leaders gathered today at Sydney's Barangaroo, where peak religious institutions endorsed a constitutionally enshrined Indigenous voice to Parliament. At the start of Reconciliation Week, Indigenous filmmaker Rachel Perkins joined the push.
And today is a spiritual gathering. There has never been such a gathering of religious groups who have supported Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, the Anglican Church of Australia, the Australian Catholic Bishops' Conference, the Australian National Imams Council, the Australian Songar Association, the Executive Council of Australian Jewry, the Hindu Council of
Australia. The call was clear.
We ask for a voice in our own affairs, an Indigenous grassroots advisory body guaranteed by the founding document of this modern nation. Not a veto, just a voice. Non-binding, but a constitutional promise that Indigenous people will always be heard, that though our advice may not always be heeded, we will always have a place at the table in this, our own country. This is a practical solution.
The Uluru Statement was agreed to by First Nations leaders after a historic conference in 2017. It lays out a roadmap with three key objectives: a voice to Parliament, treaty, and truth, in that order. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese's first sentence of his victory speech was a promise to commit to the Uluru Statement. So, does Australia have a growing consensus on the issue? Or are more and more people actually questioning the statement? Green Senator for Victoria Lydia Thorpe attended the Uluru Conference 5 years ago, almost to the day. A group of Indigenous leaders walked out because they didn't agree with the sequence of reform being proposed.
There were around about 25 people from different clans and nations across the country who walked out because they wanted to put other options on the table. I was one of them, yes, and I walked out with very respected elders and activists.
Senator Thorpe doesn't believe constitutional recognition should be the first step. She wants truth-telling and treaty in that order.
This country needs to own the truth and what we are about as a nation. We need to own the truth, how dark it is and how murderous it was. We still need to own it as a nation so then we can move forward. That's healing. Then we should be discussing treaties and having conversations about how we negotiate a way forward. That goes back to what our old people have called for decades: treaty, treaty, treaty.
Fred Hooper is the chair of the Murawari People's Council of the Murawari Nation. While he also disagrees with the sequence of reform being proposed, he's glad debate around the statement has been reinvigorated since Labor's win.
You know, I can remember a lot of the old fellas saying to me at Uluru, you know, if we're recognising their constitution, what happens to our law? And that was a major concern of a lot of the traditional owners that were there at the statement as well. It is a good thing that we're having a debate about it again, and we're having a debate about First Nations people and First Nations, you know, people's place in this country and where we fit in as well. We've never ceded our sovereignty to the Crown of Great Britain.
Fred Hooper says constitutional reform is a distraction from the importance of truth-telling and achieving a reckoning through treaty.
I think there's a lot more under that carpet that the Australian people need to know. That's the reason why, from the outset of the Uluru Statement, I've been calling for the process to be reversed from voice, treaty, truth to truth, treaty, voice. And certainly would call on the Crown to come to Australia, whether it be Queen Elizabeth II or her successor, to come to Australia and to fully apologise to the First Nations people of this country, because it's not the Australian people that claim this country. They claimed it on behalf of the Crown of Great Britain.
Some Indigenous groups are calling for a timeline on when exactly a referendum for a constitutionally enshrined voice would be held. New Indigenous Affairs Minister Linda Burney says she won't be rushed.
Carly Williams reporting. And that's PM for this week. I'm Samantha Donovan. I hope you have a great weekend.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Australia's taken a reputational hit on the international stage in recent years, mainly due to our stance on climate change that's lagged behind most other developed nations. Today, Insider's host David Spears on Prime Minister Anthony Albanese's first outing on the world stage and the mounting challenges he faces. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.